compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. I just posted something on Twitter. I thought this was interesting. It is a, what is it? It's a bar and grill, so I guess kind of a bar and grill restaurant. And I presume that this is a sign that's in the women's restroom. And it says, are you on a date that isn't going well? Is your date not who they said they were in their profile? Do you feel unsafe or even a bit weird? Is someone bothering you or making you feel uncomfortable? We're here to help. Just go to the bar or ask your server for an angel shot. If you ask for an angel shot neat, someone will escort you to your vehicle. If you ask for an angel shot dressed, someone will call you an Uber or Lyft. And if you ask for an angel shot with lime, we will call the local police. And the subtext says, we will handle these things. We will handle things discreetly and without a lot of fuss. We want you to know that you are in a safe place and in good hands. I like that. I mean, if you're in a restaurant, I mean, you could not necessarily even be a woman. What if you are a child? What if you're underage and you're waiting for your parents to show up and somebody's giving you a hard time or making you feel unsafe or trying to get you to go out to the car? I realize that this is in a bar context, so ordering an angel shot is not something that a 15-year-old can do. But I just like this. I think it's a nice proactive way to keep patrons safe, and I had not seen it before, so I posted it on my Twitter feed if you want to see it. And kudos, as I said in the post, to those who are looking out for the safety of their patrons that way. The number is 888-914-9149. Let's start off in Charleston, South Carolina, and talk to Walter. Good morning, Walter.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question about the math and its relationship to attendance for young people. But first, sure. I just wanted to ask you, I'm reading a book right now called Dying to Live by Deacon Ian Murphy, and he mentions you. I was just wondering if you know him.
Maybe I should, but the name doesn't ring a bell. What is the book called again? I'll have to look it up.
It's Dying to Live.
Dying to Live.
He was a Baptist minister, and he went through quite a struggle to become a Catholic and ultimately a deacon.
Oh, interesting.
And, he gives one of the greatest descriptions of the true presence in the Eucharist, so somewhere around page 104. But that's not my question.
Okay.
I just want to let you know about that. I've noticed, you know, I've been around for a while. I was born during World War II, so I saw the Mass before the Vatican II. Mm-hmm. And there was no problems with attendance. In fact, there was standing room really often at a Mass if you didn't get there ahead of time. But yeah. Now you don't see too many teenagers or young people who may have children. And my thought was that, you know, there used to be a high Mass with lots of singing and a low Mass, which took maybe 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. And now all the Masses run over an hour pretty much on Sunday. So I don't see too many young people there, especially young people with small families with small kids. And I think it's because the length of the Mass. So there's no option for these folks on Sunday to have a type of low Mass. Do you know if it's ever been considered?
Well, I mean, a low Mass in the world of the traditional Latin Mass, as you know so well, Walter, is the Mass in which the priest said the prayers inaudibly. That's why it's called a low Mass. And there really is no equivalent of a low Mass in the new rite of the Mass since the Second Vatican Council. So it can be embellished with more singing, and the priest, of course, could chant the prayers of the offertory, etc. But there's no one-to-one comparison or equivalent with the low Mass. I doubt we'd ever see the new rite revised in that way. So I can only guess, but I don't think that's likely to happen. One thing, this may give you some encouragement, Walter. I know, because I travel around the country and I speak at many parishes all around the country, that there are parishes that are just booming. They're bursting at the seams with young families that have lots of children. My parish is one example of that. just to use that as an example, it's an inner city parish, so people, very, very few people live anywhere within the boundaries of the parish. And there are, oh gosh, you'd lose track trying to count all the 15 passenger vans and the big vehicles with all these kids. It's very common in our parish for families to have 8, 10 children or even more. And I think that the reason that parishes like that flourish, whereas other parishes don't, or where you see large families in some parishes and you don't see them in other parishes, and this is just anecdotal evidence that I've picked up over the last 30, 35 years of traveling and being at parishes, I really do believe that at parishes where the Catholic faith is presented in a traditional way, doesn't mean you have to have traditional Latin Mass, I'm not saying that, but if the traditional forms and the truths of the faith are presented to people in a straightforward, traditional way, they flock to it. They love it. They want more of it. And that, of course, leads to, in my experience, stronger families, stronger marriages, more openness to life, which means larger families. And, of course, the car dealerships, they love it because they're selling more 15-passenger vans. And then in the parishes where the faith is skewed to the left, and it is based upon dissent, or it's a kind of content-free version of the Catholic faith that doesn't really teach the gospel, and it's rather instead a gospel of, you know, how to make people feel good about themselves. Usually that's where you see the numbers dwindle, and you don't see large families, and you don't see the 15-passenger vans. So I believe there's a strong correlation between a fearless, beautiful, winsome presentation of the Catholic faith and all of its glory, and the rise of large families and things of that nature. Now, I don't know how things are at your parish, but if you visit some of these other parishes, I think you'd be happily surprised.
Okay, well, I have gone to Mass at numbers of parishes because I really am only here in Charleston for a year and a half, and I came from Long Island and went to a lot of different churches. Never really saw many teenagers or parents with younger children. And in fact, I was on the parish council a couple of years ago, and the bishop came, and I asked the question, how long should the Mass be? Because I'm concerned about people with young children and how long they can keep them attentive and behave during an hour Mass. And he said the Mass should be no more than 45 minutes. So I've never been to a Sunday Mass that's only 45 minutes. So I, you know, just a little confused about this bishop's perspective.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you about that. My impression is that the average parish Mass lasts about an hour. But I think about, let's say, in the Eastern Rite churches where the Divine Liturgy is typically an hour and a half. And there was a stretch of about 3 years when Nancy and I and our kids were attending a Byzantine Rite parish. And so we thought, wow, this is longer than our typical parish Mass. And the Divine Liturgies were filled with families with kids, and they were able to handle it. So I think a lot of it has to do with how the kids are taught by their parents. And those that are taught to pay attention as best they can, I think they're a little more successful. Anyway, Walter, thank you. I appreciate that. One thing I noticed this past Sunday, well, actually everybody in the parish noticed it this past Sunday. I just want to touch upon it. And that is that in a parish like the ones I described, where you've got lots of families, you're going to have lots of noise at Mass on Sunday. And I see that as a sign of life, a sign of vitality. So at our parish, for example, it's not uncommon for the 10:30 Mass to sound like a Costa Rican rainforest, as one of the parish priests has put it before. You know, the Costa Rican rainforest filled with the chirps and, you know, all the sounds that the animals are making. Well, the little children can make all of their own sounds. And I think it's a beautiful thing. And I love the fact that parishes that welcome young families and make them feel welcome and are not bothered unduly by the noise that the kids make, I think it's a good thing. And we should do everything we can to welcome these young families. There was a time when I was a young dad, and so my wife and I were in that very situation. But it can cross a line when, and we saw this, and I've seen it before, and you probably have too, where a young family will not take their child out of Mass, even though the child's become not just, you know, mildly noisy. That's not what I'm talking about. But hugely disruptive, you know, crying or screaming or shouting and won't stop, won't stop, won't stop. And everybody's kind of like trying not to turn and look like, why aren't you taking your child out? It gets to the point where suddenly now nobody in the church can actually concentrate. I was talking to a lady after Mass. And, you know, there were a lot of people who were like, why on earth would they not take that child out of Mass? And this is not being insensitive to them. This is not being unwelcoming to them. It had crossed the line beyond just like normal childhood fidgeting and things like that. We can all handle that. And this one woman, she said to me, she said, you know, I'm a mom and I'm a, you know, now a grandmother, I guess. She said, and for me as a woman, this is like physically and mentally agitating because my motherly instincts are to care for this child. And you've got this child that's crying and crying and crying. And not, I don't mean like quietly, but loudly crying. And the parents would not take the child out into the hall or something like that. She said, it creates great stress for me because I, as a woman, she said, my instinct is to try to nurture and soothe this child. And I can't do anything about it, of course. And I said, I wonder how many other women who were in the church had those same maternal instincts and the same sort of effect on them. And I remember when my wife and I were young parents and, you know, we were having babies left, right, and center. And if my wife would hear a baby crying somewhere else, sometimes her milk would come in. And this is a common thing for women who are breastfeeding. You know, it provokes a kind of bodily response, a psychosomatic response even. And so that kind of thing must be taken into account. So I just offer this for those who are listening. Parents, please, young parents especially, we welcome you. We love you. We want you to be there. Bring your kids. If they make noise, that's fine. We're not worried about that. And we want you to know that you're welcome. But at the same time, you are not doing something helpful if your children are truly disruptive. And it gets to the point where other people can't pray, they can't concentrate, and people are grinding their teeth because why won't they take this child out into the hallway till the baby quiets down? Please do the right thing and be attentive to having courtesy for the other people, the other 300 or 400 people in church who also are there to pray and who would just like to be able to concentrate. Please have some courtesy for them. And it's a two-way street. We have to have courtesy for the young families. We have to welcome them and make them know that these children are welcome here. We love them and so on. But it can cross a line. And when you see that that's happening, just do the right thing. Get up for a couple of minutes, walk out into the hall, soothe the baby, come back in, problem solved. Everybody's happy. And you don't wind up having these types of things where, you know, people are leaving Mass feeling really agitated. We don't need that. And it can be easily avoided. So I thought I'd mention that because I'm pretty sure that it's not just my parish, but other parishes that experience this as well. Let's go now to Mike in Three Lakes, Wisconsin. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have some comments about your comments before about the selective service and registering for the selective service, the draft.
Okay.
I grew up, I served in Vietnam as a medic. I registered for the draft, but I immediately went and joined the Navy, became a corpsman, served with the Marines of Vietnam. Now, I have two sons who are registered for the draft. I feel that it is only fair that women should also register for selective service, simply because my sons are no less loved by me than someone's daughters are loved by them. I believe that in this United States of America, where we believe in equality, that would only be fair for them to women to be registering for selective service. I also, as a side effect of that, believe that maybe with our young girls registering for the draft, maybe our politicians would be a little slower into throwing us into wars, seeing that their young daughters are going to be serving. That's just my comment, but I did read
it. Sure, let me respond to it.
Okay,
yeah, sure. If I may, Mike, I hear what you're saying loud and clear, and I feel the same way. I love my sons as much as I love my daughters, and I don't doubt that that is the case for you and for anyone else. My concern and my opposition to the draft for women, first of all, is that especially in recent years, since the armed forces have opened, I believe, all combat roles open to women, that there would be an indiscriminate effect upon women at this point, that where if they were drafted, it's not as though they would be drafted. I mean, look at Israel, for example. It's compulsory that all men and women must serve in the Israeli Defense Force for, I think it's 2 years. It might be three, but I know it's at least two. And there's no way around it. They have to do it. And I'm fine with that. I have no objection to that as such. But my objection to women being drafted under the current conditions has to do with the fact that they could easily be put into combat roles where they're on the battlefield fighting on the burning sands of Iran or what have you. And because of the differences in men and women, I think that it's hugely problematic to force women to be in those roles. And because of the way things are situated now, they very well could be put in those roles. So if we didn't have all those combat positions open to women, I mean, if they're open to women who want to be in them, that's fine. Okay, I can work with that. But what about a woman who doesn't want to serve in the military in the first place? And if she's drafted, okay, she's got to go. And if she's put into an infantry unit, I think that opens things up for many problems because of the differences between men and women. So from a morale standpoint, from a pregnancy standpoint, from a what effect will this have on the enemy who captures women? What will they do different from how they might treat men? And you and I both know what's likely to happen. I object to it on the face of it because of the way in which women could find themselves on the front lines. And I don't know, does that clarify it a little bit further?
Yeah, well, I agree with you there. I remember when the Afghanistan-Iraq war first started, a woman was in combat. This was before Congress changed the rules for women being in combat. And she actually did defend some of the men she was with, jumped into a trench and was defending them, and she was awarded the Silver Star. And I remember on the newscast, here is this newscaster standing in front of the White House with a bow tie on in America with all the freedom of the world saying that this awarding her of the Silver Star was not legal because women, Congress has not decided at that time that women could be in combat. And I thought, you know, if you're in combat, it doesn't matter who's backing you up. You know, it doesn't matter if they're male or female. And this newscaster is criticizing this woman for receiving the Silver Star.
Right. But yeah, the difference here, though, is, Mike, the difference is that, as I said a minute ago, for a woman who wants to go in the military and seeks a combat position, or at least she's okay with it if that's what she's assigned to, that's different. I'm talking about my daughter, you know, my 23-year-old daughter, and she being forced to go into the military and then maybe be forced to go into an infantry unit and be on the front lines. That is what I object to. Now, that's not all I object to, but that's a big part of it.
Yeah. Well, I also recently read a very interesting book. I read it a couple years ago. I don't remember the name of it, but it dealt with that subject. And it specifically stated that in the book that they felt that the draft would never be started up again.
Well, the fact that they're talking about it now suggests to me that maybe in the back of somebody's mind somewhere, the possibility of the draft being reactivated is back on the table. I don't know. Mike, I do have a break coming in just a minute. So first of all, thank you for your call. I appreciate it very much. To Mike's point, let me just share with you the opening paragraph of an article called Sex and the Married Missileer. You may say, what's a missileer? A missileer would be the guy who's, or woman for that matter, who's in a nuclear missile silo. And I think this is going to get to the heart of what I'm talking about. We'll get a link posted to this. This is in First Things magazine. It goes back 21 years ago. So here's the first paragraph. At Minot Air Force Base in Minot, North Dakota, A wife kisses her husband goodbye, knowing that he will be spending the night alone in close quarters with a fit, talented, professional woman officer. He will dress next to her, sleep where she slept, smell how she smells. Although their job can sometimes be tense, for the most part it is boring, and so they talk. Over several days each week, month after month, they built up a relationship that it would be fair to call friendly. He is a devoted husband, yet he is a man, and weak as all men are weak. So, as his wife kisses him goodbye, she worries, not that his hands will wander, but that his heart might, just a little bit. She wants to trust him, but it can be hard, and she fears she's growing jealous, against her will, of that colleague of her husband. She knows she is supposed to think of her as just another officer in the armed forces, but when she looks, she sees, and fears her husband sees another woman. Now, that has to do with a real scenario, a real situation, in which there was a guy who was serving in the, I believe it was in the Air Force, if I'm not mistaken, and he objected to serving in that close quarters with a woman who was there to do her job, and there was nothing wrong with her, but his point was, this puts me in a very difficult situation, and I love my wife, and I want to be faithful to her, but if I'm forced to be in close quarters like this with a woman instead of a man, the likelihood of something happening is pretty good, even for those who have the best of intentions. So that is another dimension of this issue. Now, that's a missile silo, and obviously different military installations will have different circumstances, but I'll leave it at this, and I'll take my break. One of my sons served for 10 years in the nuclear Navy. He was nuclear reactor operator. And when he left the Navy, he was a chief. And he used to tell me, there's a lot he couldn't tell me. You know, there's a lot of stuff that he said, I'm not allowed to tell you that stuff, Dad. But he would tell me from time to time. He said, the issue of women serving on submarines is a real problem. And I said, well, let me guess, because some of them get pregnant? He said, yeah. He said, that's only part of it. And when you have men and women serving together in close quarters like that, especially in times of stress and boredom, for that matter, and whatnot, things are going to happen. And that's only part of why I object to this issue of women being eligible for the draft. I have a feeling that my position is going to go down in flames. And if I had to guess, it will eventually happen. But I don't like it. And I'm more than happy to share my reasons why I'm against it. I'll be right back.
Relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
We're back, and thanks for listening. That article that I just mentioned a minute ago is now posted. Thank you, Cyrus. It's posted on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. You can also access it directly by going to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's go to Denise now in Los Angeles. Hi, Denise.
Hi. A while back you had mentioned about I have some family and friends that are lukewarm or falling away, and you had mm-hmm. mentioned a video about hell mm-hmm. to show them, and I was trying to find it in your website, but I don't have Twitter. But if you could please mention it again, I'd like to know that video okay. that I could share with them.
I don't recall mentioning a video, but I do recall many times talking about a book about hell, and that might be what you heard. I'll tell you how to find that. If you go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, you'll see where it says links, and if you click on that, it has a link to the book on hell. It's called The Dogma of Hell, and I've had success with sharing that book with other people in hopes that it might get their attention, especially for those who are somewhat wayward. So I have a feeling that's probably what you heard me talking about.
Yes, I think that's it. I wasn't sure if it was a book or a video, but yes, mm-hmm. thank you so much.
You're welcome.
With all the talk that's going on right now, it would be very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, you're most welcome. Yeah, thank you. I mean, obviously the book doesn't make for pleasant reading, but as I say, not tongue in cheek. If somebody's on the road to hell, I mean, Jesus talked about that, didn't he? He said the road to hell is wide and well-traveled, And the gate that leads to eternal life is narrow and few find it. So strive to enter by the narrow gate, he says. So I'm just simply repeating what Jesus himself has warned about many times. And I take to heart this warning for myself. It's not like I'm sitting in judgment of anybody. I'm not looking down my nose at anybody. We're all in this together. We all have the possibility of refusing God's grace and ending up in the hot place. So I have a vested interest in this just like anyone else. So when I recommend it to other people, it's not out of judgment at all. I don't want to see them get judged. And the way I put it is, all right, if you're going to go down that wide and well-traveled road that leads to hell, you might as well know what the destination's going to be like. You might as well find out what you're going to be experiencing once you get there. And the hope, of course, is that when people realize from what Jesus and others in the New Testament said about this issue, they'll decide, I don't really want to go there. I'm going to go in the direction of that narrow gate. Let's go to Stacy in Chicago. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, Patrick. I have a question for you about the vaccine. That okay. I'm in Chicago, so my city is super liberal. We've got mm-hmm. questionable politicians, all that stuff. So the question is,
it's very kind the way you put that. I like how you put that so discreetly. We have questionable politicians.
yes. So the question is, with the schools and the churches and everyone really pushing the vaccine, I have a child who is in school and they're pushing the vaccine on her for the fall. I know that there's the option, if that's what you want to call it, as far as getting religious or medical excuse for not getting it. So what if my priest at my church is saying it's my moral obligation to get the vaccine? How do I get that from him? Or even my doctor who's saying you really need to get it. Where am I going to get this if I don't want to make her get that vaccine? Who's gonna sign off on it?
You need that ethical permission slip, right? I don't think your parish priest is going to give you that if that's his take on this issue, that you have a moral obligation. I think that's taking it too far. I mean, I could understand how we might arrive at that position, but in any case, he's probably unlikely to give you the ethical permission slip. If the doctor, your personal physician, is taking the same approach, I doubt that he or she would be willing to do that. So the only other option, it seems to me, would be to look a little further to see if there's somebody else that might do that. But I personally have said before, I have no objection to vaccines. Obviously, people are raising important questions
either
about these, you know, so I take that into account. But I mean, is she adamant on not receiving the vaccine because let me ask you this way. What is her reason for not wanting to receive the vaccine?
Mine, there's not enough research. And, you know, they can go on and on about how it's safe and all that stuff. But there's also the question of infertility. And the possibility might mm-hmm. be super tiny. But until I hear and see more research on it, how can they tell if it's a new vaccine? And everybody talks it's just a variant of all of this, and now they're coming out with new, oh, we're going to put in three masks, there's a new smallpox. It's going to be a new reason for them to keep pushing the vaccine. It's, you know, all the uptick in the people that are contaminated all over, you know, the numbers
keep
going up.
Let me share something with you. And Stacey, you're saying something that many people, including many that I know, have very strong feelings about. So I acknowledge the fact that you're raising some issues that in the mainstream, there's a great deal of effort trying to stomp on people who raise those kinds of questions. So I hear mm-hmm. what you're saying. You might want to take a look at the Wall Street Journal. There's an article that was just published called "The Flimsy Evidence Behind the CDC's Push to Vaccinate Children." And I'll share with you a little bit of this article, Stacey, if you want. And then we'll get it posted for you so you can read it for yourself. The article is written by Marty McCary. Who says, a tremendous number of government and private policies affecting kids are based on one number, 335. That is how many children under 18 have died with a COVID diagnosis code in their record, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Yet the CDC, which has 21,000 employees, hasn't researched each death to find out whether COVID caused it or if it involved a pre-existing medical condition. Without these data, the CDC Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices decided in May that the benefits of two-dose vaccinations outweighs the risk for all kids 12 to 15. He says, I've written hundreds of peer-reviewed medical studies, and I can think of no journal editor who would accept the claim that 335 deaths resulted from a virus without data to indicate if the virus was incidental or causal, and without an analysis of relevant risk factors such as obesity. He says, my research team at Johns Hopkins worked with the nonprofit Fair Health to analyze approximately 48,000 children under 18 diagnosed with COVID in health insurance data from April to August of 2020. Our report found a mortality rate of zero among children without a pre-existing medical condition such as leukemia. If that trend holds, it has significant implications for healthy kids and whether they need two-dose vaccines. The National Education Association has been debating whether to urge schools to require vaccination before returning to school in person. How can they or anyone debate the issue without the right data? Meanwhile, he says, we've already seen inflated COVID death numbers in the U.S. revised downward. Last month, Alameda County, California, reduced its COVID death toll by 25% after state public health officials insisted that deaths be attributed to COVID only if the virus was a direct or contributing factor. Now, he gets into quite a bit more about this, but he's making a very important point, and that is, if that number, 335, being the number of children under the age of 18 who died and had a COVID diagnosis in their record, and he's saying, you know, as a physician, as a scientist with peer-reviewed journals who have looked at the work that I've done, and his research is being done at Johns Hopkins University, and they're looking at this data, and they show that, as he says here, approximately 48,000 children under 18 diagnosed with COVID, and the mortality rate is zero, apart from those who had another condition, a coexisting condition like leukemia. And leukemia, as we all know, that will kill you. You know, if it gets bad enough, it'll kill you. And so how do we explain, or how do we justify, he's asking, and I think it's an important question to ask, how do you justify this mass vaccination program for children who apparently don't need it? Why are they being forced to be vaccinated when we have, on the one hand, certain questions about how will this affect a child? And also we have the hard data that's been peer reviewed that demonstrates that unless there is a comorbidity or some other condition that the child already has, like leukemia, for example, the mortality rate is zero with regard to COVID. So for you, Stacy, and for anyone else, parents, grandparents, whoever else, if you're interested, this just came out in the Wall Street Journal, and it is written by a scientist who has the evidence to back up what he's saying, and you can evaluate it for yourself. The only problem is that there are plenty of people on the left who want to stomp on anybody who dares question the way this is being promoted. So that's one more reason why you can trust us here at Relevant Radio to do our best to bring you as much information as we possibly can. Let's go to Jeff in St. Charles, Missouri. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. I was just calling, I guess, with regard to your earlier discussion on the safety and efficacy of the COVID vaccines and the analysis of the risks and benefits of receiving it. And we were told to follow the science, and yet our government and church leaders, many businesses and organizations seem to be promoting and implementing rules and regulations, pressuring people to get the vaccines, and they are not following the science, you know, from what I can tell. You know, I looked at WHO numbers on the infection fatality rate, which is different than the case fatality rate. And in 20 countries, they did those studies, and the fatality rate for those who were infected with COVID was 0.23%. That means 99.77% of the people have recovered. And if you do the math on that, based on the number of people that they say have died in the U.S. from COVID, that means over 80% of the people here have already been infected and recovered from it. And then if you have another 50% plus who have been vaccinated, you know, that would mean 90% plus of the U.S. already has some antibodies to this, you know, so it seems absurd to be forcing people, especially in the extremely low risk categories, you know, students. I have a young student that they're going to make him wear a mask and be tested every week if he will not get vaccinated, you know, and I know they're pressuring, you know, they're firing people, you know, if they don't get that at businesses based on the government stuff. And at Mass, we're told to, you know, sit in the back of the church and have to wear masks and kind of be, you know, segregated from everybody else. You know, it's almost like you're a second-class citizen and so on. And it just seems absurd on that, especially for the church, when you look at the moral issues of these things were not only experimental, and there are deaths and, you know, a lot of concerns on the safety, but also the morality of using aborted fetal tissue when it is not necessary. There are places that have shown that they have adult stem cells available for them to use for these kind of things. They do not have to use it. And if we go ahead and use these, they have no incentive to change. They'll just keep using aborted fetal tissue.
You do not know what you are talking about, quite frankly. And I want to say that officially. You do not know what you are talking about.
Dr.
Yeah, I
Fauci.
I have a lot to say about Fauci, too.
Dr. Fauci might say that to you if you are perceived to be bucking the system. Who is he saying that to, Cyrus? I think it was Senator Rand Paul, if I'm not mistaken.
You are correct, sir.
Yeah.
You do not know what you are talking about.
And he's been proven to be a liar on that. There are videos on the web now showing him admitting that he had funded gain-of-function tests on those coronaviruses in China, right where that escaped from. But that's a kind of a separate issue.
Yeah, I understand, Jeff. Well, I can do my very best to try to keep abreast of what's being said, and I realize that there is conflicting information. No question about it. So we're trying to sift through it and do the best we can, but thanks for the call. Thanks for raising those issues. We have to take a break. We'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this.
You do not know what you are talking about, quite frankly. And I want to say that officially. You do not know what you are talking about.
Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Cyrus, you remember, well, I know you remember because you posted it on Twitter, but I had a conversation a year or two ago with a young woman named Maddie who called in, and she was, she didn't like what I had to say in an earlier call about contraception in marriage. And so she and I had a lively conversation. And
come on, man.
That's the one. Let's hear that again.
Come on, man.
Yeah. I can't get enough of that. Give me a few more of those. Not just
come on, man.
Come on, man.
Come on, man.
Come on, man. What are we talking about?
We're talking about Maddie. So a lot of people who heard that call have talked about it ever since then. So, Cyrus, I just want to give you a tip of the hat. Thank you for posting that. You posted that call with Maddie kind of out of the blue, but when I saw it yesterday, I was really happy that you did it. Let me hear from her again.
Come on, man.
Yeah. So it's a lively phone call.
She's a great call. If she's listening, I wish she would call back.
Me
she
too.
She was great.
Excellent phone call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we discussed the issue of contraception. I wish we could have talked about it longer because there's more I would have liked to have said.
Yeah, I wonder where she's at now. You know, that was 2 years ago that she called.
Was it two?
Yeah, it was already 2 years ago. But when I listened back to that audio, I was like, this is as relevant right now as it was any time. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, let's give this another go on the Twitter rounds. And it blew up over the weekend. So if you haven't seen it yet, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, and it's just a few spots down there on the Twitter list.
Come on, man.
Come on, man.
Let me hear her again.
Come on, man.
Yeah. That's so endearing. I have a kind of affection for her, especially after that that phone call. I don't think she was feeling too positive about where I was coming from on this issue.
She thought you were crazy.
I think
she thought you were bonkers.
She said I was. Like how, it was dangerous advice.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. She called it dangerous. And she's like, "Oh, I'm responsible for. I don't have free will. Are you saying I don't have free will?" And you're so. Yeah. She's getting so angry, and you're so calm. It's just it's a really fun call. So if you haven't heard it, go check it out. It's great.
Yeah, and thanks for posting it. So that is. As of, I think you posted it yesterday, if I'm not mistaken. So I will retweet that so that it's at the top of my Twitter feed as well, and then you'll be able to easily find it. It might be something to share with some of the young people in your life. Anyway, back to the phones. Thanks, Iris. Let's go to Anne, listening in Seekonk, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Patrick. I want to say it's good to talk to you. I respect you tremendously, your intelligence. And the way you control yourself speaking to some of the callers.
Thank you.
It must be difficult. What I want to say is, you're welcome. I heard what you said in the beginning about you trying to figure out why people have such anger and all this when you were talking to your wife. And for me, the answer is really obvious. Comes to me that it's nothing short of spiritual warfare. What is going on?
With regard to what issue? People who are angry about what?
Everything. Politics, the vaccine, racism.
Oh, I see what you mean. When I was talking about there's a kind of an alloyed mix of political anger and anger at the church, and it's sort of one thing now?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes, I think it's spiritual warfare that's going on, because remember when Pope Leo XIII wrote the St. Michael the Archangel prayer, mm-hmm. that he had overheard a conversation between God and Satan before he wrote that, and this is Satan's last hurrah, and he's going down, and he's not going down without a big fight. This is a big spiritual battle, and you can see it. If the chaos, the confusion, the division, that these are the tools of Satan, and this is what's going on in our society right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think the answer is.
Yeah, there are two things I'd like to share with you, and both of them you probably are already familiar with. The first one is what St. Paul says in 2 Timothy 3. Tell me if this doesn't sound like the times that we're living in right now. But understand this, that in the last days there will come times of stress, for men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, inhuman, implacable, slanderers, profligates, fierce, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, holding the form of religion but denying the power of it. Avoid such people. Now, I'm not saying we're in the end times, but I do believe that this description in the first few verses of 2 Timothy 3 are very, even startlingly, reminiscent of what we find ourselves in now. So that's the first thing I suggest.
I think we are in the end times. I'm not saying
we might
the
be.
End of the world.
Well, the end times and the end of the world are the same thing. The end times are leading up to the end of the world. And I take the same position you do. I'm not saying that we are. There are some days when I wonder about it, though. It seems like,
yes,
I
do think we are. And what you read in the scripture is an exact description of what's going on right now, I think.
I agree. Now listen to this. This is a second one. Now this comes from 1977, I believe it was, when Pope John Paul II was visiting. He was visiting the United States, but this was before he had been elected Pope. So he was a cardinal still, and in his visit to the United States, I believe it was at the Eucharistic Congress in Philadelphia that year, he said the following. So cast your mind back to 1977. I think this is when he said this. He says, "We are now standing in the face of the greatest historical confrontation humanity has gone through. I do not think that wide circles of the American society or wide circles of the Christian community realize this fully. We are now facing the final confrontation between the church and the anti-church. of the gospel versus the anti-gospel. This confrontation lies within the plans of divine providence. It is a trial which the whole church, and the Polish church in particular, must take up. It is a trial of not only our nation and the church, but in a sense, a test of 2,000 years of culture and Christian civilization with all of its consequences for human dignity, individual rights, human rights, and the rights of nations. So that line where he says we are now standing in the face of this great historical confrontation, the greatest historical confrontation, he says humanity has gone through, and he identifies it as the final confrontation. So that gives me impetus to imagine that maybe those words that we discussed, Anne, in 2 Timothy may be, in fact, describing our own generation. We'll see what happens. In the meantime, though, we should take encouragement from knowing that greater is he who is in us than he who is in the world. So if you're close to Jesus, if you love Jesus, if you're standing on that rock upon which he's building his church, then you're going to be fine. Come what may, you'll be fine. Thank you. Let's go now to Nancy in Atlanta. Good morning, Nancy.
Hey, Patrick. I just want to make an observation. I participate in several tinnitus, which is ringing in your ear, Facebook groups. And I joined these groups in April of this year. And there are more and more people joining who state they got tinnitus and or hyperacusis, which is noise sensitivity, after getting the vaccine and or the COVID.
Oh, interesting.
That is my...
My wife and I were having this very discussion, not about COVID per se, but we were having this very discussion with a good friend of ours, and she does suffer from, I've always heard it pronounced tinnitus. Now, maybe I'm mispronouncing it.
Yeah, but I think the medical field says tinnitus, and lay people say tinnitus. Either way is correct.
Right, but it's that maddening buzzing in the ears that some people must deal with. Oh, I can only imagine. So she was describing her situation with that, but it didn't get into the question of the vaccine. So are you saying that some people who have had the vaccine noticed that they then got?
Oh, definitely.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Interesting.
And now on this particular.
Oh, you know what? We had a problem with the phone lines. What happened there, Cyrus?
I don't know. Every single call just dropped.
We had full lines.
Yeah. If you were waiting, we apologize.
Oh, boy. Oh,
hey, good. And now we're back. Hey, okay. Look at that.
How strange.
I don't know if it's all the same calls. Yeah, it is.
I don't know what just happened, but anyway. Well, that's fine. We still have some time left. Let's go to Joe. And I apologize. I forget the name of the lady I was just speaking to. I apologize, but everything went blank. That was Nancy. That's right. Everything just went blank. So I apologize for that. Let's go to Joe now in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how you doing, Patrick? Patrick, I just make a comment. I'm in total agreement with you regarding women in combat roles. Military. I retired from the Navy back in 2006. I was ship's company on an aircraft carrier.
Joe, put your mouth closer to the phone.
Okay. I was on an aircraft carrier ship's company back in the early 80s, and at that time they didn't have women on combatant ships. And they used to send out reserve units to train on board the carrier. And a lot of times they brought girls, and it was just like everyone's focus was on the women. And I just think it's a bad thing for morale, because then you have guys fighting. You have to remember, kids that are on board aircraft carriers, average age is like 19 and a half, 20 years old.
Right.
You have a lot of
And what do you think they're thinking about all the
women.
Time?
Women.
And what do you think the women are thinking about all the time? Men?
Well, getting off the ship. the thing is that they're out there and they don't like it. And it's like, how can I get off the ship? And it's funny that you mention that, because years later, I was in Norfolk, Virginia, attending a school. And I happened to come across a chaplain from one of the carriers that was homeported in Norfolk. And I said, what is it like to have, co-ed crews, a compliment on the ship? And he said, a big problem. And before he said anything, I knew right away what he was going to say.
Yeah.
A lot of women do not want to go on a 6-month deployment. That's usually the amount of time that you go out, anywhere from 6 to 9 months, depending on what's going on in the world. So to spend 6 months out at sea, the way they can get out of it is become pregnant, which creates problems for everybody, because now you're going to have a manpower shortfall because so-and-so just came up.
the phones just did it again. I think old Hairy Legs is trying to mess with us. That's okay. Because Hairy Legs, guess what? We're almost at the end of the program. Ha ha. You lose. But that's okay. Sorry, everybody. We had, again, full phone lines and something just happened. So I'm not sure about that. But Cyrus, did you notice that it was just a moment or two earlier before it happened the first time that somebody brought up the issue of spiritual warfare? Did you notice that?
And then bam.
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 Just like that.
Every time.
That's okay, though. That's okay. Well, you know what? We'll sprinkle the phone lines with holy water next time. But we're out of time.
Could it be Satan?
I don't know. I see the potential culprit. Ah, okay. Well, I retract that then. In any case, we'll be with you again. Same Pat time, same Pat channel tomorrow. In the meantime, be sure to stay right there and listen to Josh and the Inner Life coming up right after this. Josh Raymond is your host, and he will be with you in just a few moments. So stay right there. I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.